Welcome to Leaders and Legends of Online Learning, a podcast dedicated to the experts. Thank you for listening. Each episode, we'll be learning from the world's leading thinkers and practitioners in online learning and linking to ideas relevant to online teaching, working with online learners, and digital education. You can listen to the experts and check their profiles and link to some of their work on our website, www.onlinelearninglegends.com. I'm Mark Nichols, the interviewer in this episode. You'll meet Professor Tony Bates in this episode. Tony is one of the online learning theorists who got me started, and as you'll hear, he's had a marvellous career to date. I recorded this interview with Tony in a Milton Keynes pub, so it's a great chat over a pint. Tony talks in particular about the sections model covered in his free book. Listen out for Sultans of Swing, Funky Town, and enthusiastic locals in the background. Well, I'm here with Tony Bates, who is a professor of e-learning from long ago. Tony, you're our very first legend of online learning, so thank you for being the inaugural interviewee. It's really wonderful to be with you here in a pub quite close to the Open University with a pint, a wonderful way to start a podcast series.
And very appropriate for me as well.
Thanks for joining me. Now, Tony, but before I get underway, I need to confess something to you. It was your book, Technology, E-Learning and Distance Education, that started my career in online learning some 20 years ago. So it was a very, very formative book. I had it handed to me by my manager at a New Zealand polytechnic and said, you should read this, you might get something out of it. I thoroughly devoured it, and it completely changed my view of what distance education could achieve. And I went on to do the MAODE with the Open University. So I owe you a very special thanks, actually, at the very start.
Well, that's very satisfying and also very terrifying as well. I feel terribly responsible now.
Good. I could blame you for a lot, but I think I need to thank you most sincerely. So, Tony, can you start off by just by giving us a brief overview of your career and some of your publications?
Yeah, I stumbled upon the Open University by accident in 1969. I was a researcher in education. I was looking for a job, and the Open University had just been created. It hadn't started yet, and they were looking for a researcher to look at distance education and provide the university with some information about what was going on in distance education. So I started by looking at the NEC BBC programs, which were a kind of forerunner. The Michael Young had got National Extension College involved with developing a partnership with the BBC. And what I noticed when I was doing that research was a big difference between the way students responded to the broadcasts compared with the print materials. And I thought, as a researcher, I thought, there's something here. And I was right. The broadcast played a very different role, but nobody knew at that time. You know, you made a program and you did your courses, you did your print materials, and the reactions were very emotional towards the broadcast. You know, people either loved them or hated them, whereas they were very rational and thoughtful about the print materials. So I went on and looked at research into television and radio to start with, broadcast television and radio, and then audio cassettes came along, and we looked at what impact that had, and we found some very interesting things there, that students learnt a lot better when they could record the material and play it back. And then people like John Mason came along and made audio cassettes interactive, so we realised that students needed feedback, and feedback was important. So a lot of things came out of that early research which are still very relevant today. By 1989, I guess I've been here for 20 years, I've become a professor here. I'd been to Canada and seen what was happening with the internet there, and I came back and worked on DT200 with Tony Kaye, and we added on an online module or an online element to that second level course.
And was that the first time the OU had tried online learning in any way?
Yeah. I was a course author. It was on technology and society, and I was writing something about educational technology, but also Tony and I were trying to get the online discussion forums going using a system then called COSI, a Canadian system actually.
Yeah.
But then we ran into a kind of, over a period of time, probably a couple of years, we ran into a roadblock. The university wasn't interested, it saw it as an extra on top of everything else.
Yeah.
and it was the end of Thatcherism in Britain, and my wife and I had fallen in love in Canada. We met in Canada, although she's English, and we decided to emigrate. My kids were going to university. So I went to the University of British, originally the Open Learning Agency, where I worked for 5 years, and then a very traditional, classical research, top-tier research university in Canada approached me because they saw online and digital learning, even then in 95, as very important.
Yeah.
And one of the first things that came out of that work there was Blackboard, WebCT, which was eventually became Blackboard. Yeah. And that was developed at University of British Columbia. And I wouldn't say I designed it, but I actually put some money from my course development budget into paying for the research assistant. So I had a little bit of influence on the development of Blackboard. So you can blame me for your terrible learning management systems in some sense, although I didn't design them, I just funded them. And then I had a very good 8 years at University of British Columbia. We started fully online learning, fully online courses, and then eventually fully online programs. We developed a Master's in Educational Technology, fully online. Started as a certificate program, but by 2003, with the Faculty of Education, we developed a Master's program, which has been very successful. Self-funded, student fees are exactly the same as the on-campus fees, but it's actually makes quite a bit of money for them, and it doubled the number of graduate students in the faculty overnight.
Oh, great. Now, when you say online or fully online, does that mean there was no print?
No print, no.
No other medium at all? It was just all online?
Yeah. Yeah. The design changed a bit over the years, and I left and other people came in, and we had some very interesting course design developments as new people came in, and particularly what I call agile design. It's a regular university, so it doesn't have, it had 200 students a year in the program, but on each course there's probably about 30. So with those kind of numbers per course, you could get them out more quickly and you could be more experimental. Yeah. And if you got it a little bit wrong the first year, it was not too bad, you know. 30 students suffered a little, but you learned from that. So it was a more dynamic environment. And then I left. I got mandatory retirement at 65. But I'd been bringing in a lot of consultancies to the university. We developed a partnership with Tec de Monterrey in Mexico. I was bringing in quite a lot of research money, so I didn't feel ready to stop. And they wanted to do a reorganization, which they didn't get it right at the beginning, but they needed to reorganize because I was basically working out of continuing studies, but it was most of our students were credit students. They were in the regular faculties, and it made a lot of sense to move that under the direction of the vice president academic rather than director of continuing studies. So I took a not early retirement, but I was coming up for retirement, but it made it easier to do that shift. And so I took the consultancies with me and set up my own consultancy company. And that's probably been the most productive 15 years of my life, actually, because I've been traveling the world. And the interesting thing about being a consultant is that you learn more than you teach them. Yeah. You learn how other people do things, you learn what works and what doesn't. And so it's been a very productive 15, 20 years for me since I officially retired.
Great, and you're obviously still in the game as well, you're still enjoying it.
Yeah, yeah.
Great. Well, Tony, there's been a number of ideas and themes that your work has provided over the years. Which of those do you think are still pertinent today? Which of the ideas that you've researched, the findings that you've made, do you think you can still take off the shelf and apply?
Yeah, I think probably that the most important stuff I've done was actually at the OU, which was the research intermedia. A lot of that research has been, or a lot of the findings have been replicated more recently, particularly by Richard Meyer in the US. But that early research into the what I call the affordances of different media, what they're better for, what they, you know, what and how they differ, I think that's going to become increasingly more important now as the internet starts to involve all the media, you know, audio, text, computing, and so on.
Yeah.
And, you know, we're going to have to be a little bit more thoughtful about what the advantages and disadvantages of each of those are. So I have a sections model, which I think many people have found works quite well, which enables you to take a holistic view about choosing technology from an instructor's point of view. So I think that is probably the most important. The other thing that I think is very important, I did a lot of work on the management aspects about policy for towards online learning. I haven't done so much of that recently, but I had a book called Managing Technology in Higher Education, which basically provides guidelines for senior management. And unfortunately, senior managers don't read that kind of book, you know. So it's not been very successful. Whereas my book, Teaching in a Digital Age, which was written mainly for instructors, has been much more influential. Obviously, a bigger market there as well. And much to my surprise, although it was written for university and to a less extent college instructors, it's been used heavily in the for teacher training as well. And that's very satisfying because it means it obviously resonates with a lot of people beyond the group that I actually was writing for.
That's great. And that was the most recent book you prepared online?
Yes, it's fully online. I think another reason it's popular is it's free.
Great, and we'll provide the URLs with this podcast. I do remember actually you ran a webinar at one stage on your book. I can't remember which chapters it was.
Contact North is one of my clients. I've been done a lot of work for them. They've been very supportive. That they have been offering four webinars on the book, on different aspects of the book, and they've been very successful. We've had 50, 60 people for each webinar. Each time we've offered it, it's been sold out. We cap it at 50 because I can't handle more than 50 comments and discussions.
Brilliant. Thanks, Tony. The third question relates to your observations about online learning and education at the moment, so here in the 21st century. So it's now April 2018. Your work, I think, spans probably three decades, if not more. Where do you think online learning is at the moment? What are your impressions?
I think the world at last is changing. It's been a hard fight up to now to get universities and faculty to take online learning seriously. I think that is now happening. Certainly in Canada, we're seeing major shift in teaching as a result. The first kind of wave of getting regular institutions to see online learning and distance education as part of their normal work and not something that's done off to the side. That's happened already in Canada. We got 98% of all universities in Canada now offer online learning for degree programs. So they may not offer a lot of courses, but they offer some. We've got about 16% of all teaching and learning in universities in Canada now online, so fully online. The next stage is just beginning to happen, and that's the blended learning, hybrid learning. Faculty who've been teaching on fully online are beginning to realize that they can integrate parts of that online into their face-to-face teaching. Also, students are driving faculty to online learning. The students are going online. They're finding information. They're bringing that into the classroom. So they're, in a sense, putting pressure on the faculty to do something here as well. So I think it's a great time to be in online learning, actually. It's probably the most productive time. Yes, you still have battles, but they're not like they used to be. It used to be online is inferior to face-to-face teaching. That's almost gone away now. I'd like to do online. What's the best way of doing it? And that's a big shift in the last 5 years.
And it's being demand-driven as well as supply-driven. So students are actually asking for that.
Not so much the students. Well, students and faculty, but faculty particularly, I think. It's been very interesting. The senior management in most conventional universities saw the need earlier than the faculty, and the faculty resisted, but now that resistance seems to be, it's still there amongst many faculty, but there's enough now doing it to make as much as the institutions can handle. And now the students also are beginning to see the advantages. So I would say administration 70%, the faculty about 50%, and students about 30% are moving to accepting online learning as being fully equivalent and sometimes better than face-to-face.
It has taken some time, hasn't it? So you mentioned the first OU course in the 1990s. And only now are we actually starting to see any real progress.
There's always been, it's been gradual, you know, but it's now got, I suppose the technical term is a tipping point, where it's gone beyond being experimental and around the fringe to becoming central. And it takes, you know, it takes 20 years to get a university to change in that way, you know.
20 years?
Okay. Yeah. I mean, seriously, if you think about it in terms of how the universities don't change very much, you know, and they haven't changed a lot since the 16th century, 15th century. So, you know, we tend to get impatient, and things outside the university change faster, but inside the university, I think 20 years for a change is pretty good.
Fair observation. So, Tony, given your perspective on online learning, what research would you most like to see at the moment? If there's any grad student listening to this, wondering for a topic to pick up on.
There's one outstanding question that is amazing that nobody has really tried to look at this, and that is, what are the affordances of face-to-face teaching compared with online learning? Now, I don't think there's a single answer to that. The answer is going to differ from subject area to subject area. And also depending on the needs of the student. But it's clear to me that in some subject areas there are some things that it must be better to do face-to-face than online, and vice versa. We don't have a theory for this. We have almost no research on this. We have a lot of research about fully online versus face-to-face, or blended learning versus face-to-face.
Yes.
But we don't have that critical thing that a faculty member has to, or an instructor has to decide, is, okay, I've got my course, now what should I put online? I can do it either way. It doesn't have to be fully online, doesn't have to be face-to-face. So how do I decide what it should be? Or you can put it another way, for conventional universities, why should the student get on the bus and come to the campus when they can do it online? So what are you offering on the campus that makes it sufficient to make it worth a student come on campus and convince them that this is an experience worth having?
Yeah.
And I think in the long run, this is going to change the campus, because we've gone from a campus that was very, you know, in the old days when it was an elite, it was a very social thing, everybody knew one another, it was all about the clubs and the societies, and then we went into mass higher education and all that disappeared and became community universities.
Yeah.
Well, now this mix allows us to really focus back again on what the role of the campus is. So my interest is not so much on the online, we know what we can do online, my interest now is, well, where does that leave face-to-face teaching? So I think that's the area I like to see researched.
Okay, so the affordances of face-to-face, the sorts of things that would add value to the educational experience if verbally or physically presented, as
yes,
opposed
because
to...
you know, some things will come down to cost, you know. Yes, you can do remote labs, but it's might be too expensive and you can't scale it up, whereas, or you've already got the investment on campus in labs, so why would you go to remote labs? So it may come down to cost in some case. That's why I think the sections model will work very well here. You know, what are the student needs?
Yeah.
You know, are the students 18-year-olds who want to mix, want to have girlfriends at university and so on? You know, they'll want the campus. So we could apply the sections model to it. But we need a lot more research, and we need a lot more evidence, you know, to say, well, these are the important factors.
Absolutely. Actually, while we're here, can you give us an overview of the sections model?
Okay, S stands for students. It's in order, roughly in order of importance,
yeah.
And it's like a checklist for a faculty member thinking about, you know, do I need to put some video in here? Do I need to, you know, because on the internet, you've got the choice of every media except face-to-face. So you still got that choice with face-to-face as well. So you might say, I can do all these things online except this, which has to be done face-to-face. So,
yeah.
So start with the students. So where are they? What are their needs? Do they have access to the technology, etc.? E is for ease of use. How easy is it for the students and the faculty? Do you have to spend hours teaching them how to use the technology?
Yeah.
Unless it's part of, you know, learning, unless the topic is learning the technology,
yeah.
You don't want a technology that's hard to use. So,
right.
You know, that's why I like mobile phones so much, because faculty can use mobile phones, students can use them very easily. You can create pretty good videos, you know. So ease of use, I think, is very important. Cost. Now, cost used to be the big driver. You know, if you had a TV program, that was very expensive. And it still is for some of the new media coming in, like augmented reality. Yes, we can do lots of things in augmented reality or educational games, but what's the cost of doing that? And can you scale that up? Can you scale the students' learning up enough to justify the investment?
Yeah.
Whereas a lot of the other costs have come down, like the cost of accessing the internet has come down dramatically for most people. Mm. So cost is, used to be the main driver, but it's less of a driver now. Yeah. Then T is for the teaching functions. What do different media, how can they help the learning process? And there are two things there. One is the representation of knowledge. What's the best way to represent knowledge in this area? And the second is, how does it help develop skills? And those are the two questions I would ask about the technology before deciding to use it.
Yeah.
Interaction, does it allow for interactivity? Organisational issues, if you've got £20 million invested in print, it's going to be hard to move away from it, you know. Can you crack the management and make them change? Or can you just, or is this part of the flow, you know? If I can go with the flow, it's always better than try to fight the administration. So I've come across that quite often. People have wanted to use the technology, but the IT people didn't want to do it, or the management didn't think it was worth the effort. Mm. And it's really put people off from using it. And it's for novelty. You know, some faculty say, well, this is neat, I like to do that, you know, and, you know. And S is for security and privacy. Does it protect students' privacy? Is it a secure system? Can people hack it easily? So that's the sections model.
Yeah, but it's still very, very relevant today. And actually, interesting, you pointed out that the cost dynamics, how they've changed. Yeah. So a model that the actual framework is consistent, but the relationships between them have certainly changed over the years.
Yeah.
Now, I'd like to finish with quite a difficult question, actually. I'd like you to name two people you'd recommend as future legends of online learning. So one, perhaps, whose work you've admired historically. One, perhaps, whose work you've come across recently you think might be a shining star in the future.
I would recommend somebody called Tanis Morgan. She works for a very interesting organisation called the Justice Institute of British Columbia.
Yep.
They train fire, police and ambulance, social workers, first responders. It's like a mini open university because all their students are working. They're scattered all over the very large province.
Yep.
What they've done is to introduce things like tablets, iPads and so on, to all their students, so wherever they are, they can study. And what she has done is enabled that kind of fully mobile learning environment. Everything is mobile at the Institute. She's also recently done a contract in a Mexican university, University of Guadalajara, to teach all the faculty how to use iPads in their teaching.
Right.
Her group has taught 800 faculty members, and she's got another contract to do another 800. It's a very large university. And they also have a very interesting simulation package for emergency responders, where they have a set time, they have to make sure they're free for an hour for this time. And they get an emergency, comes over their iPads, it's a little newscast saying there's a fire in the docks in Vancouver.
Yep.
And they all have to respond in real time. And there's a kind of coordinator who throws in little things to put things off, like the bridge is down, you can't get across the bridge, what are you going to do?
Yeah.
And they have to respond in real time, and they record all that, and they come in and have a debriefing afterwards about what they could have done better. And so she has been very innovative. She hasn't done all this herself, but she's created the environment for getting their staff to come up with good ideas and help them implement that. And I think she's been a driving force for innovation in learning technologies in Canada. Now that one's a little bit out of left field, because a lot of people won't know about her, and it's not a big organization and so on. Terry Anderson, I think, has done tremendous work in Canada with his Communities Inquiry, working with Randy Garrison.
Yes.
So you know, Terry's semi-retired now, but tremendous force in Canada for online and distance learning.
Mm.
But those are two that I can think of at the moment. And again, there are more likely to be people I know. There are probably lots of other people out there that I don't know that I should be recommending, or I don't know well enough to recommend.
Absolutely, yeah. But it's really interesting that these two people have made such an impression on you. So
yes.
I'll do my best to follow up with both of them, actually, and see if I can invite them two to become legends of online learning.
Yeah, well, we need some Canadian legends as well. So
absolutely. Tony, it's been a real privilege. Thank you so much. And I think you are a very appropriate first person to have in the Legends of Online Learning. So thank you very much.
All right. You're very welcome. Can I get my dinner now?
Tony's free online book, Teaching in a Digital Age, can be downloaded from the URL shown on our website, which will also link to Tony's other titles. His website is www.tonybates.ca, and his Twitter handle is Dr. Tony Bates. That concludes this episode. Be sure to go to our website, www.onlinelearninglegends.com, to follow up on this episode's guest. You'll also find links to others whose ideas continue to inspire and teach online learning professionals, and you can subscribe to future interviews. If you know of a leader or legend we've not yet talked to, please do drop us a line at onlinelearninglegends@gmail.com.